Okay, my name is Andy Gordon. Today I'll segue into talking about computers from what we've been doing so far, and actually I'll double back again next Monday or whatever, based upon some things that have come up. But I do think some people came to hear computers. I want to at least begin it as best I can with the time we have. Now I'm going to try to discipline myself to a manageable amount of material. I'm also going to, this will be the most technical talk I've given, because I've learned that people are sufficiently put off by computers and unaware of what they do, that it always helps to have a little bit of talk, at least, about how the devices operate. And I think I'm able to construct that in such a way that it also lets us get into the talks of how accurate the machines are, which is the essential emphasis today. So let me begin by saying that I'll be talking in particular about a set of machines called digital computers. And it's an important distinction, because the machines which people used to be used to were called analog computers. The difference between analog and digital is important, especially with respect to our major topic. The watch that you were used to, the one with a sweep second hand and the numbers that seem to move continuously, is the equivalent of an analog computer. Things sweep across its whole distance. We've sort of done away with those now in favor of digital watches. Digital watches are watches that operate in discrete steps. So when the seconds change one at a time, and you can see exactly when they change. I remember when when we first got digital watches, I had a sense that something was being lost, that I was interested sometimes in parts of seconds. And I didn't have to estimate them, and now I have to estimate them. So there's an important transference already when you accept the accuracy of a one kind with a digital watch, you're often giving up another kind. Phonographs have been analog devices. Essentially, when you play a record, what you have on the plastic surface that's being read is a continuous surface that looks like the peaks and waves of a mountain. And what the needle does is pick up those peaks and waves and valleys and transfer them exactly into a similar pattern, which is delivered through, after it's been amplified, delivered through a speaker. Okay. It tries to represent exactly these peaks and waves. Digital devices, and so the complexity of the wave is evident. For example, if you look at a microscope, you can tell. You can see the complexity. That's not at all true with digital devices, and we now have digital recording devices even. Okay. When we talk about digital devices for recording or anything else, we're talking about transferring this analog of information, this relatively continuous information, into a discrete patterns, which are based almost entirely in the systems we now know about, in zeros of ones. Zeros and ones. How many of you know this system and know anything about how it operates? Zeros and ones are called bits of information. Bits is short for binary digits. There are a lot of advantages to digital systems, which we'll be talking about. Binary systems have only two characters, but they aren't, I'm going to develop this a little bit, perhaps more than some people are interested in, because I want you to recognize that it's not foreign matter quite as much as you might have anticipated that it was. The number system that you're used to, called the decimal system, is really just a variation on this theme. So when we write the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, we're using all the symbols that can be used in a single column. There are 10 of them, 0 through 9. If we want to represent a number larger than 9, we need two columns, But 10 is not an arbitrary, doesn't have an arbitrary relationship to 0 through 9. In the Roman numeral system, numbers in various columns had arbitrary relationships. So after you had 1, 2, 3, 4, the next symbol was 5. Again, back to one column, a symbol which had no evident relationship. And when you got up to 10, you needed something entirely different. Very hard, very complicated to do advanced math in a system like that. And many people consider that to be a limitation on a culture, that they had such a system. Whereas 10 has a particular relationship to 9 that I'm going to express in algebraic terms. I expect that everybody, from my experience, won't follow it all, but some people will find it as a breakthrough. So at least I want to mention it to you. The number 10 in what's called the decimal system is equivalent to 0 times 10 to the 0 power plus 1 times 10 to the first power. The first column, if we look at, let's take a number that's had 3 columns, 1, let's make it a little more complicated, 265. The number 265 has a particular relationship to what you can extract from one column. This is equal to 5 plus 10 times 6 plus 100 times 2. This is the tens column, this is the hundreds column, then we have the thousands column, then the 10,000s column. We have multiples of 10 as we move to the left. And that extends in both directions from the decimal place. So every number has a precise relationship which allows our number system to operate. It's relatively compressed. There are 10 symbols in any column. But I'm going to try to show you that the same information can be precisely mapped into any of a number of what are called number system, modular systems. But the only one I'm going to talk about today is the decimal system. So you notice that we call it the decimal system. There are 10 characters, 0 through 9. Because decimal means 10, and there are 10 characters in a column. And then in order to represent the next largest number, we need 2 columns. So the number 10 requires 2 columns to be represented. Okay. And after the number 99, 3 columns are necessary in order for a number to be represented. Okay. But this has an exact analog, an exact mapping into the binary system. So in the binary system, instead of dealing with powers of 10 as we are here, 10 to the 0, then 10 to the first power, or 10, then 10 squared, or 100, and so on, we're dealing in powers of 2. So the number in what's called the binary system, the numbers are 0, then 1, and in order to represent the value 2, we need 2 digits. There are only 2 numbers in a single column, so the number 2 in the binary system is written like that. That is to say, 0 times 2 to the 0 plus 1 times 2 to the first power. Okay? So let me show you over here that each of these has an analogy in the decimal system. The binary number to represent 0 is 0. To represent 1 is 1. To represent 2 is 10. To represent 3 is 1, 1. Can anybody, for whom this is a new experience, tell me how you would represent the number 4 in the binary system? I'll write it for you, and then let's trace it down. 100. 1 times 2 squared. 4 plus 0 plus 0. What's the number 5? 101, what's the number 6? 110, what's the number 7? 111. And then when we get to 8, we're into another power of 2. Number 9, and then number 10. Okay, and so on. Now, this seems like an awfully silly thing to do. Here we were dealing in a decimal system we thought we understood that was supposedly derived from digits. And we knew how to deal with it, and all of a sudden, from nowhere, these engineers come up with something that looks more difficult, mostly because we're not used to it, less compressed, more unwieldy, harder to deal with. You can no longer recognize the numbers you could before. Why was this done? Well, ironically, it was done on behalf of accuracy, which is why I'm bringing it up now. In order to be able, let's say you and I were several hundred yards apart, and you wanted to communicate to me a very complicated number, like 876, and you wanted me to get it. Okay. Well, if you yelled at me, there's all kinds of trouble getting that information from one end to the other. What if you didn't hear it exactly correctly? Well, let's invent a signal system of some sort. Well, if we're going to have a signal system that's based on the decimal number system, we have to have 10 different signals, right, for 0, 1, or whatever, in order for us to be able accurately and precisely to pass this information to one another. And remember now, we're not passing information merely over 200 yards, we're passing information to and from the moon. What would that signal system, how would that signal system operate? Well, if we were able to speak binary to one another, and if we weren't worried about the fact that it's relatively uncompressed, then what would we have to be able to do in order to communicate? You'd have to either know, for example, whether I have my hand up or I didn't have it up. And that would be sufficient information. Because in each case, you'd only have to know whether there was a signal or there wasn't a signal. Okay. So if we were able to deal with a binary system, I could, at 200 yards, much more precisely get information to you. The trouble is it's not fast. Well, what is it that isn't fast? It's us that aren't fast. So let's get a machine that's very fast. And then we can, realizing, by the way, it doesn't have to be just arm up, arm down. It can be I'm clapping or I'm not clapping. It can be I'm yelling or I'm not yelling. But the nuances aren't necessary if we can string enough of these digits together to get the information passed from one to another. Now, is this a limiting system? Well, if we can entirely complete this mapping, it doesn't have to be limiting. And we're dealing with powers of 2, so we've got a lot of these digits, in fact, a lot of these digits. Do you remember story was originally from, but there was some king who felt indebted to somebody who'd worked for him and said, I'll give you anything you want. He says, I have only a simple request. Here's a chessboard. I'd like you to put one piece of wheat, one grain of wheat on the first square. And then I'd like you to put 2 grains of wheat on the second square. And I'd like you to double up the number of grains on every square until you complete the chessboard. The king thought it was a simple request until the calculation was made, and they found that by the time they got to the last square, there would be more grains of wheat on the board than there was grains of wheat in the earth. So if you deal in powers of 2, it isn't very long before you're talking about very large numbers. The trouble we have to deal with is speed, because we've dealt with the accuracy problem at the very limited level. It's either on or it's off. Also, electric signals can be dealt with this way, and this is typically how it's done in computers. You deliver a current through a circuit, and the current is either signaled as being there or as not being there, or sometimes high voltage or low voltage. And what a computer does is string millions and millions of these individual bits, binary digits of information together. Typically, they're strung together into things called bytes. even though bits have to be exactly represented, and typically they are, the basic unit that humans typically communicate with computers in is bytes. Bytes are a sufficient string of binary digits so that individual characters can be represented. Every character has a representation in binary digits, and these are called bytes. There's lots of room for puns in this field to come up because we have Apple computers and we have bytes and so on and so forth. There's a magazine on the Apple II computer. There's a magazine that comes out from Albuquerque that's called Peelings 2 because it's peels for an apple, and 2 because it's for the Apple II computer, and their logo has on it, Apple owners have peelings too. Okay. So everywhere you can't get out of the pun mentality once you get into the computer world. The computer that the Apple company now has, the Macintosh. The next machine is now called the Jonathan. Any of you listen to Garrison Keillor? He has had some recently. He's been doing advertisements for the Golden Delicious, which he said is truly the computer for the rest of us. He says that it stokes the fire at night. It turns on the coffee in the morning, and most important of all, it'll go to the door, recognize if somebody there is a salesman, and if it is, I'll talk it. He said, that's truly the computer for the rest of us. So anyway. But to make this viable, it's got to be fast. And that's what computers are, extraordinarily fast. We now talk, we now talk not about operations in seconds, but operations in very small parts of seconds, millions of seconds, and even billions of seconds. The number of operations that can be done per second is now calculated in the billions. There are very few machines, only the largest crane machines that really do things in a single billionth, but nevertheless, the term is with us. It's called a nanosecond. Nanosecond is a billionth of a second. Now, the trouble with numbers like this is that it sounds like a part of a second, like a tenth of a second is part of a second, as if we understand it. This is way beyond our comprehension, really. A nanosecond is to a second, as a second is to 32 years. So the fraction of a second that a nanosecond is to be contended with. This is serious business. And they're beginning to do things even more quickly in some ways. So femtoseconds is the next step, trillions of seconds. These are the fractions one has to think about, or that the computer people are thinking about. Now, the nanosecond, by the way, is also the equivalent of it's equivalent in space of going a foot at the speed of light. Another thing that makes you think about is that the speed of light has now become an inhibiting resource for our computers. They're getting smaller in part so that they can get faster. Because if you're talking about billions of seconds, then a foot is a large distance. And you have to get elements small enough, close enough together so that you don't have to worry about the fact that you're merely moving at the speed of light. Okay. It's another ball game out there now about how these machines operate and how you think about them. So I try to communicate something about how the decimal system works, how the binary system is really derivative of it, at least in the way the computers work, and what this means. Well, what about accuracy? Well, do you see at least how, if you think about number systems at all, and if number systems are a way to represent reality, that we have no new limitation by dealing with a binary system with only two simple symbols, any more than we would in the decimal system. So there's nothing new with respect to whether mathematical utility represents reality accurately, except that it probably does it better than any machine that we've ever had before because they're so damn fast, because so much information can be captured. There's a level at which it's possible to say then To err is unlikely, to forgive unnecessary. It's a rare computer that makes a mistake at this level. Almost always when students of mine say there's something wrong with the computer, my program isn't working, the last place to look is at their, is at the computer. Because this art of representing things accurately in digits and building backup systems that lets you be sure that even if the first system fails, the backup system will work, is so highly refined that the computer is, by the time it gets to the market, by the time people are actually using it, the computer is rarely the problem. That doesn't mean they're problems, and I'll be coming before too long to what those problems might be. Now, it also is true that this is a more simple-minded system than this is. At some level, this should be easier to teach, and computers, in fact, are even more simple-minded than that. For all the flexibility they seem to have, they're really only capable of doing a very few things at their rawest level, at their most primitive level. Everything else is a matter of add-ons. There is, the term computer itself is relatively ambiguous. Most people think of the whole machine that has a keyboard, that has a screen, and so on. But the computer, as typically talked about by the computer scientists, is a very small chip, generally called the central processing unit, the CPU, where the thinking is taking place. What is the thinking? By thinking, in this instance, we mean pure calculation. And the kind of calculations computers typically do are additions and forms of additions. A multiplication is, for most computers, a very fast addition. A division is a very fast subtraction, which itself is a form of addition. Between that single operation and varieties of them that develop on some chips, and the capacity to store and move information around, from that we're able to derive most of the power of what the computer has. So it isn't its fundamental operations that are particularly interesting or complex, it is the speed with which they can do them. I mean, and as somebody said, any simpleton that can do a billion operations a second has to be contended with.
Is this a point to ask the difference between an 8, 16, 32, 64 chip?
Sure. You know, let me say, would you interrupt me at any time to disagree with me or to push me in any direction? Because I don't know the crowd well enough to know. I mean, I'm caught in a tension between having technical talk about computer, which could go on and does for quarters and semesters, and moving on to larger issues. But yes, I think it can't hurt, right? Computers, the first machines that are generally available were called 8-bit computers. That essentially meant the amount of information that could be simultaneously sent from one location to the other. It also had something to do with how, with the level of accuracy that was possible. The operating instrument, with a particular location in the machine, could store up to 8 bits of information at once. A bit, remember, is 1, 0. Okay, so CPM machines, and in fact most MS-DOS, IBM PC machines, are some version of an 8-bit machine. Well, everything in the computer is actually in binary steps. So 16-bit is just the next multiple of 2. So a 16-bit processor can deal with twice as much information at once. And a 32-bit processor, which is the only kind that's typically available, there are some 64-bit processors for the professional world. How about that, speaking of errors? 32-bit processors are the largest that are typically available. This also gets very complex because there's For internal purposes, there's external lines to the world. There are really 16 32-bit processors out there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
as I understood it, the 8-bit could handle 8 times 8 or 64 signals, because if it could handle 8 separate things, then 1 and 0 and one and one and zero could be the, and so it could handle 64 different pieces of information, or the 26 letters and the numbers and a few other signs.
Right.
Is that correct?
It's, yes, although you can, even the most primitive computer, by using that same location again and again, can represent any particular piece of information of any complexity. What you lose is speed. But it's correct that typically they think about the richness of the instruction set as having something to do with the number of bits of operations. There are lots of kind of memory that people confuse with one another. Typically, at this level, they're talking about the central processing unit, the 6502, the 68000, the 8088, the chip, the central processing unit around it, which the computer is based. But there's another kind of memory. It's called RAM, random access memory. This is memory that the computer can get at very quickly, memory that's addressed by the central processor. And the amount of memory that can be directed, that can be addressed directly by the central processor is a function of the bit size of the central processor. So there's that relationship. So when you talk about a machine that has 1,000, 1K of RAM, and that's a K is a number, I guess we should at least have to explain a little bit. The original computers weren't typically larger than this. I now have a machine on my desk that has more capacity than the major machine my university had when I came there 15 years ago. 1K of addressable memory means, K is in kilometer. It stands for 1,000. But remember, we're always dealing with multiples of 2 in computers. So in fact, it stands for 1,028. When you have a K of, they even talk about 1,000 bytes of memory, they really mean 1,028 bytes, because a computer always deals in multiples of 2. So 64K RAM is 60, which is a typical small computer, is 1,000, is 64 times 1,028, not 64 times 1,000. Okay. There's that kind of memory. There's another kind of memory called read-only memory. Let me say one more thing about types of memory that should be why this fact that it's randomly accessed is very important, because I think that's useful. Essentially, think about a cassette, audio cassette. What if you wanted to listen to the last half hour of a talk that somebody gave up here? The only way you could get to the last half hour would be to pass by the first half hour, right? You'd have to actually physically skip a half hour of tape in order to get to the second half hour. And you would have a counter of some sort that would get you approximately there. That's called sequential memory or serial memory. Random access memory, for example, on the closest thing that you're, I guess, aware of in life outside of computers is a phonograph record, where if you want to hear the fifth piece, you just have to pick up the needle and put it to the place where the fifth piece begins. It's essentially as easy to get something in the middle of the record as it is to getting something at the beginning, as long as you're able to locate yourself properly. Random access means that the computer is able to address any piece of information anywhere in its memory space as quickly as it is able to address any other piece of information. So long as it has a directory, something that lets it know what's where, then you have that capacity. So, okay.
We have that like in the dispatch center. It's unbelievable.
Right.
We can go to any place on any given day or tape and pick it out.
Right. So you come across limitations there that have to do with the amount of random access memory that's available to you, rather than the location of any piece of information on it. Right. And the speed with which it can be accessed. Okay, now, the one thing that's hard to come across in this Berg is a newspaper. And I don't know whether this will do or not. Let's take even though this may look like a continuous picture, in fact it isn't. It's a series of squares, very small squares, which are either dark or light. It's on what's called grayscale. It has various shades of dark or light. So if you got close enough, and especially if you take a magnifying glass to a picture, you're able to see that this is not a discrete, this is not a continuous image. It's a lot of discrete dots. Okay? The more dots per square inch, the more accurately that image can be reproduced. Okay? So when a computer draws an image of a character or a picture on the screen or so on, the accuracy of the image depends upon the density with which these individual squares or pixels can be written. All right. So one of the advantages of having more and more memory is the density of the image that's possible. So long as that image can be finely drawn and quickly drawn, then the limit again becomes a matter of human image processing. At what level do we construct this as a continuous image? At what level is this an accurate representation of this person? Right? And people differ with that, differ from one another on that. But there's a general tendency to regard at a certain level that you have accurate enough information. The level at which computers are now striving at an affordable level is 1,000 by 1,000, or really, once again, 1,000 28 by 1,028. Okay, at that level, a picture seems to have the density that it appears to people to be a full image. Think about moving pictures. You know what moving picture is. A moving picture is a certain number of discrete frames per second. But if they adjust, what is the level at which, is it 16? There's some number of frames per second where the eye perceives that as a continuous image. It's not a continuous image. It's a bunch of discrete steps. Okay. So that's another thing about whether or not a computer is accurately representing the kind of information it has that at least I wanted to bring up to you. Now, how does a computer deal with the information it has, and how does it decide, how is it possible for a computer to make, for example, decisions upon the information it gets? Well, computers are, at this stage, and in the stage that anybody is working on, I think, in the immediate future, fully determined. That is to say, it can only deal with information that it absolutely knows. Just this yes, no, on, off, zero, one decision the computers are capable of is all they're capable of. So if a computer is to make a decision, for example, the decision is always of the form true, false. And true, false in a computer is precisely determined. If it's not true, it's false. And how is it true? It's true only if it fits, if it follows precisely determined definitions of what even computer scientists will sometimes call validity. It's like a set of mathematical operations. And the mathematical operations have to be fully described. So you can say if, for example, x is greater than 0, then something. Let's say that's true. So if this number is exactly, by its own calculations, greater than 0, then this would be said to be a true statement. Okay. If it's not exactly 0, or if it's the opposite, which is less than or equal to 0, then it's said to be a false statement. And everything that about which the computer can make a decision has to be so described. But think for a minute of how we would describe the conditions under which a missile should be launched on the Soviet Union. At some point the computer has to process the signals and make up its mind that this is a dangerous enough event what's called launch on warning, which is the step that people say we've gotten into the next step. How would you characterize the equation such that the launch must take place? Computers, there's a certain level of accuracy that's the problem. We're able to move at such a fever pitch, and we're able to use the guidance systems to develop the pretense of accuracy so intensively that there comes a point when only the computer can be trusted to process the information that it's given in making the decision. But that means at some point you must absolutely define the information with which the computer is supposed to be operating. Does anybody want to take a shot at if all the computer operator can do is say, okay, now you want me to launch under certain conditions. Describe those conditions to me. How should one go about describing the conditions that provoke a launch? What should that consist of? You can say, let's say the computer is able to deal with text. I don't think we're going to be able to get into this today. But let's say that we want the computer to recognize that the person at the console is Ralph. So the computer is supposed to recognize Ralph. Okay. You can say to the computer, if person equals, let's say then shoot, okay? If person equals Ralph, and you define it to the computer that way, capital R, capital A, capital L, capital P, capital H, and you ask the person to identify themselves, and they type R-A-L-P-H, capital letters. If it was set up this way, that person, Ralph, would be shot or would have been given the capacity to shoot, let's say. Well, the computer programmed this way would reject the person who typed R-A-L-P-H. Because this is as different from that as Mary is from George. It has to be exactly spun out. Okay, you can say, okay, well then we'll make our decision rule a little more complicated. If the first letter is a capital R, then no matter what the rest of the letters are, we'll accept this person as Ralph. But then Roger would be allowed to shoot. Or if we said accept R-A-L-P-H, that'd be perfectly reasonable, but it's another set of programming strategies that would have to be built into the way the computer works. Well, humans typically, if they make certain kinds of mistakes, make certain other kinds of mistakes. And you might forget to have the shift key elevated or something. So typically they can be set up to do something as simple as that. But even that turns out pretty sophisticated programs. There are a lot of teaching machines that are used in schools now that break down at this level. They don't know what to do with capital letters. They can't contend with misspellings at all, right? What if a person typed R-O-L-P-H? I have a friend named H-A-R-A-L-D, Harold. He always has a hard time dealing with computers that are set up to recognize certain kinds of people because there are their expectations about appropriate formats. Well, all I mean to be getting at here is the decision to launch a missile is this decision in spades, right? How do you define the context in which you recognize when it was an accident that should be responded to in a certain way, a computer error of theirs or ours that shouldn't be responded to at all, a bird that happens to be misidentified as a missile? How do you describe a bird? How is a bird different from a missile? The trouble is, we can have a nice philosophical discussion about that, and it may entertain us or it may bore us to tears, but it may set the world on fire if we don't get it right. That's the trouble with computers. With respect to accuracy, they have this is how the idiot stuff comes back in again. There's a term in computer technology and computer terminology called, which, I'd be interested to know how many people have seen this and know what it might mean. GIGO.
Garbage
in, garbage out. Well, this is usually used as a terminology by which computer technicians put down the rest of us, who say, we don't know how to speak to the computer properly. Okay, that is, it's garbage to have a person spell their name with all capital letters if any fool knows that only the first letter is supposed to be capitalized. It's garbage if the person puts two spaces between their first and last names when any fool knows that you should only have one space. Okay, well, that is garbage as far as the computer is concerned. I like to call it garbage. Because I think at that point it's the computer's problem, not our problem, that it's unable to recognize this problem. And again, I think we're going to talk about computers and education next week, and I think there's a fundamental issue that comes up there, but I'm more worried about the launching of missiles. Because I'm afraid that I've told you everything there is to know about computers today. There are a lot more details in this, but they're all iterations. There's no escape from these problems with any machine that I know of.
They're so literal, aren't they?
They're absolutely literal. And none of them get out of this business. There are a lot of other things to say. They're sequential, and that's a problem. They only do one thing at a time. I mean, there's a problem with whether they can ever be intelligent that we'll also be talking about next time. But I think it literally is true, as simple-minded as this seems, is I've now laid bare the computer. Now, it can process a lot of different things according to these rules. It can process pictures, it can process music. When does a computer sound like an instrument rather than sound like a computer sounded like an instrument? It sounds like an instrument when the amount of information that it's processing is sufficient for the human ear not to know the difference between the instrument and the signal. Remember, I started talking about analog signals and valleys. Well, whether or not, let's say this is a signal that's delivered from a violin. Whether or not the computer makes that machine sound like it's a violin depends largely upon how many bits of information I have available to me to describe, for example, that part of the waveform. If I only have a few bits, then I'm going to get a very rocky description of it. If I have more and more bits, I get a more sophisticated description. And finally, I have so many binary digits available to me that the human ear is unable to tell the difference between the computer's delivery of a signal to that speaker over which we're listening, and the violin's delivery. Okay. So there are a lot of things like that are going on, but this accuracy doesn't get us out of that problem. And this problem is the problem of launching on warning. Anything? I have a lot of directions to go in, but does anybody want to disagree with me or ask particular questions or have a discussion? I got a lot more to say, but I'd rather have a discussion if people have things to bring up. I wish it were more complicated than this. I recommend to you, by the way, I put the set of readings together, and there's a set in here by Joseph Wiesenbaum called Joseph Wiesenbaum is a computer scientist that at MIT who is now an anathema of the profession because he keeps asking questions. He's on the wrong track as far as they're concerned. Wiesenbaum got started as a very sophisticated computer scientist. He wrote some of the most important early representations of computers. He first got to become a critic, and he still is there. He beleaguers the industry because he's such a persistently articulate critic. Because he wrote a program called ELIZA. ELIZA was a therapist. And what it did is you would ask it a question, and it would give you an answer, and it would say, how do you feel about that, and tell me more, and so on and so forth. And the thing that worried him was that people took it seriously. He thought it was a game, but people that sat down at the computer thought they were talking to a therapist. And for him, that was the problem, not the solution, because he knew what he programmed in, and he knew how tawdry his decision rules were, and he knew when he'd said, tell me more. And he knew how it took care of things that it didn't understand by changing the subject, et cetera, et cetera. So he really began to think, not about the machine, he loves machines, but about the pernicious consequences of these machines given to people that don't know what the hell they're dealing with, what the machine is, what the consequences might be. So he's written, this book is called Computer Power and Human Reason. I think for our discussion, I've taken two useful selections from it. There's also some other things that I hope to get at more next time. There's one called Why Models Go Wrong. It's about this subject. And there's another by Eric Hofstadter on mathematics and metaphysics. It's sort of an excursion into artificial intelligence that I'll be talking about when we talk next week about computers and education. Please, let's have a conversation.
There is.
Just take off on how easy you say it is. Star Trek, Mr. Spock is basically the computer, the logical mind sort of thing, but he could never be the commander of the Starship Enterprise. You know, it had to be Captain Kirk, who somehow, when push came to shove, when the decision had to be made, Spock's logic just could not do it quick enough, and Kirk just out of somewhere did the right thing. Rather than worrying about the computer, can the computer teach us anything about how we just have those hunches, those intuitive somethings that makes us know not to push the button or not to, or to stop the computer from doing what we're afraid it may be doing?
I think if the computer could teach us that, then we could trust the computer to make the decisions because it would know what the hunches consisted of. I think it's really asking more of the computer than we should ask of it.
Well, not a teach, but if we can learn that that's the limitation of the computer, then can that help us focus on where what the strength has to be for us, because that is a true limitation of the computer, rather than trusting the computer once we know its limitations? Or based on that, do we also have those same limitations, which makes it even more?
Yeah, I guess the more general issue here for me would be that computers aren't going to go away, and they're going to get faster, and they're going to be more and more contentious with us for space.
So how do we control it?
And how do we develop a proper relationship between us and the computer that the system operates as best it can to make appropriate decisions? The discussion by Wiesenbaum here called Just in Time in one of the chapters I derived is really incredibly good from that point of view. Because he said, you know, essentially talks about how we had such a welfare system that had gone out of control. It wasn't doing its job anymore. And he said, what the computer did, we said the computer came just in time. And he said, that's right, it came just in time for us to do more efficiently what we were doing so badly before. That is to say, it didn't make us think about what was wrong with the welfare system that it had gotten to be what it is. It had rather preserved that system by processing checks more quickly, for example. Mm-hmm. So that one thing computers allow us to do is not think through the consequences of our actions. Because typically the people that control the computers are the people that are making decisions, and they will employ them to make efficient the things that let things stay essentially as they are. He does a very good job of talking about computers as efficient instruments. There's a statement in there too where he talks about the pig principle with computers as they get faster and faster. The economists, he says, have something called the pig principle. It says, if something is good, more is better. So computers are fast, let's make them faster. Computers are small, and they have to get smaller, let's make them smaller so they can do their job more efficiently. It's possible to proceed in that way. If we have trouble figuring out launch on warning, what warning consists of, how do we figure out what love consists of? How do we figure out what hope consists of? How do we figure out the proper relationship between the computer's metaphors and our own, because the computer metaphors can only be used on the basis of things that we've thought through fully. And I think from a philosophical point of view, almost all the things that are important we haven't thought through fully. And not only that, they're continually evolving. Computers cannot evolve in the way they deal with things beyond the ways in which we tell them to. And if we can't articulate them in language that computers can deal with, there's no solution there. Now, somebody said if a person is falling into a hole, it doesn't help him if he can fall faster and more efficiently. The problem is the hole. And computers are efficiency-producing instruments in behalf of things that they don't understand.
Dialogue is not particularly an efficient way of doing business. They don't facilitate dialogue, can take away. I'm thinking of yesterday Posner's comments about the relationship between the USSR and the United States governments, and how quickly we're dealing with a little bit of information, but no dialogue.
Right. There are ways, actually, I think, again, with some stuff I've been doing with Jody, I'll try to describe very primitive ways in which we're trying to use computers as dialogue, promoting food requests. But the first thing you have to do in order to move in that direction is to equalize the power somehow. Mm-hmm. Because if you start off with a dialogue with certain people controlling all the technology and all the information associated with that technology, and other people come a step down, then the dialogue is not particularly meaningful. That's another thing about the penetration of computers that we haven't had time to do. Any other comments?
Could you talk, Andy, you deal with people who deal with computers all the time, and you read the literature, and think more than anybody I know about what it's doing to the human spirit and sort of the character of people. Is there a way to describe a new sort of character that's emerging in the culture that is somehow determined in some primary or important way by their interaction with the computer?
I haven't thought about this enough to feel comfortable saying much. The book that tries to deal with that is Sherry Turkle's book, The Second Self, I think it's called. It's about the character of the computer in new generations. I do, but I can certainly reflect on it from a practical point of view. I'm thinking of agencies we've worked with that have relatively enriching and enriched definitions of what their job is. Let's say an agency that's supposed to deal with abused children and know how important it is to spend a lot of quality time with kids. But all those agencies operate on a shoestring. They have very little money, very little financial support. And they depend upon a certain kind of continuing support from the government or from whomever. And so the reports to make. The reports are always based upon things that somebody has codified in forms and in an instrument. So the government will tell them when they have a successful program. And they tend, in spite of themselves, in almost every instance I know about, to begin to govern their behavior and how they spend their time in terms of things which satisfy the machine, that is to satisfy the forms that have to be filled out, as opposed to what might have been their much more ennobling definition of what their work was before there was a machine around. I mean, it really is something looking over their shoulder that has become a real problem. We'll talk next week some about the implications of computers in business settings, where secretaries now, instead of being able, for example, to work on a work product from beginning to end to have some sense of it, sometimes they're given a page out of a document they've never seen before and which they don't understand, and they're told to make corrections and move it on to the next person. So there's something about the meaning of work that supposedly the computer makes more ennobling by taking some of the worst parts of what we do in terms of over the machines, that in their real consequences in many workplaces are not having that impact on people at all. So you come away from work, which is now a machine laden, more nervous, more provoked, more anxious, more depressed than you were before. So I'd say the direction is not a positive one. I don't know whether that's a necessary consequence or not. It's a likely consequence if somebody doesn't intervene. I think we've...
I worry a little bit about the whole privacy issue computers have made it possible for us to get any kind of information about anybody that we want for just a few cents. For instance, I run a big computer operation, and I can get the names of anybody who has $100,000 in one bank or $250,000 in one. And get their name, address, phone number for any county or people in the United States, and I can get that within 7 working days, 5 working days, for about 23 cents a piece. Or all kinds of other lifestyle information that saw a list the other day, I think it was about 25 different things. The United States is broken down into blocks. And in that block, the people who own Cadillacs and Mercedes are another group, the people who are married, the people who have kids, the people who have professional things, all about, and you can pick out any of those lifestyles, and I can send in a list of names on a tape, and they'll match them and give them back to me in a week.
Yeah.
So I can pick out the people who are married and have children and drive Mercedes and walk their country club and earn $100,000 more a year, and get a list of names out of my 50,000 names.
Supposedly that's correct. I mean, confidentiality is another big topic. Now, always the government has some answer to that. For example, if there are too few Mercedes on a block, then they won't tell you who's the owner, because they try to, what they say, protect the individual confidentiality, but it turns out that's nonsense.
It's not so.
Well, and let me say other issues of privacy that are also about computers that you don't think of so quickly. People think about the confidentiality issue. Right now, if that noise were loud enough and we're in this room, you might not be able to hear me. But with the help of computers, the computer could separate out the noise that's due to that machine so that it could hear me better than you can. So that when American citizens are in the Soviet Union, microphones can pick up their conversations from across the room or across the street, no matter what they do, turn on the shower or whatever. It's no longer the case, but that's not about microphones and their sensitivity only, it's also about computers. Because if you didn't have computers that could, you know how people know how the Dolby system works? The Dolby system essentially enhances everything on input, and then on output it suppresses the noise and leaves the rest intact. So the noise is separated out. Well, that's what computers can do that's just a very single-minded computer, but much more complex computers, you can do that in any situation.
How do they take out noise from noise? I mean, music is noise too.
Well, what it does is you describe the signal you're interested in, which is sound of my voice, and it takes everything else out. When signals, you notice the next time you see any images from Mars or Venus or whatever, they say computer-enhanced images. Do you remember that? Computer-enhanced images are about getting the noise out so that you get a picture that is more accurate than you would had you had a camera there, because it knows what kind of things it has to contend with flying from there to here and correct for those. That's it. Now, if you bring that down to human scale, that's about privacy too. I'm not sure if Thor is safe 20 miles north of Ely. No. And all these things wouldn't be possible for if we worked for computers. And there are people out there who can advantage of that.
It's kind of scary. It's relevant because this past week, our computer operator ran off out of our 50,000 names and addresses. I had to run off everybody to whom we did not have a telephone number. And I put that on a tape.
Right.
And when I get back, we'll send that to New Jersey, where they'll match that with 250 million people. And
give you phone numbers where possible.
Yeah, yeah. And it'll come back within 5 days with their phone number.
For people that are able to come next time, we're going to be talking about computers in education. So there's some chapters in here with Derek Bach and some others that are obvious from the title, which you might want to read. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Where would we find this book here?
This book, it's on some table at the bookstore.
Okay.